Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net. This is Outcast World, and today we are talking about a ruling that could reshape public life in Britain for trans people, but also for anyone who's ever stepped outside the narrow boundaries of what people decide a man or a woman is supposed to look like. Because this isn't about trans rights anymore, it's about who gets policed, who gets questioned, and who gets made to feel out of place in their own body, their own workplace, their own local pub, gym, or toilet. The EHRC guidance dropped like a bombshell. It was confusing, it was chaotic, and it sent fear right through the queer community. Jamie Wareham and the team at Queer AF have spent the last few years doing some of the smartest, most forensic reporting anywhere in queer media, cutting through the panic, the spin, and the bad faith. And today, Jamie's here to explain where we are now, what this ruling actually means. He's going to try and find some of the positive points in there, and he's found them. And if you're a butch lesbian or an effeminate gay man or anyone who is remotely gender non-conforming, Britain all of a sudden feels like a different country. This is Outcast World.
Queer politics.
When Farage says jump, Labour might say how high.
And it's not true. It's offering people false hope.
Sex.
Dating apps have become a breeding ground for the worst of human behaviours.
And culture.
What do you want, homie?
We get together, we be simple.
Simple.
It's simple for me.
He will like go nosh himself off.
This is Outcast World.
So it was shock and awe, wasn't it, before the weekend when the news just dropped about the EHRC, and I feel like nobody really had a chance to process it. It was like, what? And then it's a bank holiday weekend, there's 3 days, and then people are kind of processing it now and realizing that this has been an appalling injustice, really, I think, for anyone who hasn't been following this hour by hour. Could you just walk me through it? Supreme Court ruling, EHRC guidance, code of practice before Parliament. What's the situation? What has happened? How have we got here?
Yeah, so, you know, if we speed back to a year ago, we had a decision in the Supreme Court that no one expected, not anyone in the judiciary, not anyone in the media, not anyone in the LGBTQIA plus charity sector, that a woman, as defined by the Equality Act, and very specifically the Equality Act, no longer included trans women, which obviously had an impact on the reverse on trans men. And more broadly, big questions over anyone who's gender diverse, trans plus, non-binary, where they fit within society. Over the last year, we have had countless court cases trying to challenge that, trying to make it clearer, make it defined, and those have been brought by both pro-trans and anti-trans forces. What we have, after all of that, is anything but clarity, despite what the politicians and some pundits are saying. This week, we got another curveball, which is also designed to create a sense of clarity, but I think further adds to the, you know, and compounds the confusion we're all in. So the EHRC, the UK's equality watchdog, has produced something called the Code of Practice. It's something they've already had to rewrite once since the Supreme Court, after the Equalities and Education Minister, Bridget Phillipson, sent it back to them for a redraft. So this is a redrafted version of the Code of Practice. And what it says is trans people are protected from discrimination, but it also then sets out how you can quite lawfully, for want of a better phrase, discriminate against trans people or exclude them. What is important to take away, though, as a top line look at that sort of like speed through what has been a really confusing and long year for people like myself and anyone in this sector, is that exclusion, we was expecting it to be forced. We was expecting the government and the EHRC to say, you must exclude trans people. It hasn't done that. It has said, we recommend in most situations you exclude trans people, but it leaves room open for people to remain trans inclusive. And I think that's a really important takeaway that everyone needs to hear, because it's being lost in the very understandable fear, anguish, worry, and, you know, headlines from the usual culprits that don't kind of give the nuance that a story like this deserves.
But the Good Law Project was doing a lot of work on this, weren't they? And they took, it's very complex what's gone on. People kind of just think these things go through straight away, but it's gone for review and back. And in the review, I believe the Good Law Project managed to get some changes that were, I'm not going to say it's watered this down, but it's certainly softened the edges. It's really interesting for you to say there that this kind of pushes the onus for almost policing this, policing gender, right back down to the people. So, like, oh, we're not giving you anything. You know, you can or you maybe not, and just confuses people. The EHRC says trans people won't be left with without any facilities at all. The organisations have a duty not to leave them stranded. In practice, how much comfort does that offer? I mean, there's not always a disabled toilet, is there? What, are we going to move into a world where it's disabled people and trans people saying, what is going to happen?
Well, that, I think, is part of the problem with this guidance, is that it toes the line, like, all the way through by saying, we're not actually doing anything to trans people. We're saying trans people need to have services. But then it says, but they're not supposed to have the level of services that, you know, cisgender men and cisgender women have. And therefore, the best option, given that no one's got any money and the economy is bad and we can't ask you all to turn all of your toilets from, you know, single sex to gender neutral, is, you know, it's probably just easier to put them in the disabled loop. That's the kind of, you know, overwhelming outcome. And I'm simplifying it, but there are significant parts of this code of practice that say that quite specifically. That's going to be a problem, not just for trans people who are being pushed into a third space, which essentially by law treats them like a third gender, like a third sex. It also causes problems for disabled people who already struggle with, you know, accessibility to these spaces, because they too have not for very long been afforded protection or requirements to be provided spaces for. And so, you know, it's sort of a bit of a double whammy in that this was intended to sort of, you know, on some level, this all happened because there are forces that want to harm the trans community. But they haven't just harmed the trans community, they've harmed many more. And as you alluded to, part of the thing that we've seen with any legislation or laws that are about bathrooms based on gender, create a gender policing kind of narrative. So we've already seen in the last year some quite high profile, significantly known cisgender women being attacked or abused in women's toilets because they don't look women enough. One of the things we wrote in the newsletter in Gwireth this weekend is, you know, this should be a wake-up call for anyone that maybe hasn't been following this closely. And I, you know, speak specifically to kind of gay men who think this hasn't been a thing that bothers me. You know, we as a community, whether we look camp or not, are men that don't have sex with women unless we're bi, right? And so that's, we're not already not man enough in their views. And so the kind of narrative,
we fall in that space.
Yeah, we are the sort of people that are now going to begin to get questioned for whether we should belong in these spaces. Like, that's next. That is what we are not that far away from.
That's so true. That pathway that we're now on is kind of like, well, you don't look masculine enough. So can you pop to that third space, please? And the people who are policing that, they're not going to be decent people, are they? I don't think decent people are going to start talking to people in toilets like that. The code isn't technically law yet. I've seen a lot of stuff on TikTok from people in the trans community essentially crying. Like, I have 40 days left of my ability to exist in public life. A 40-day scrutiny window. Is there any realistic chance that this might be stopped? And what's Queer AF's position on what should happen now?
So I think it's very unlikely that it's going to get challenged in Parliament. So we're not going to bore you with the ins and outs of Parliament, but like the top line is, it's a really high barrier in order for this to be stopped. A massive coalition of cross-party MPs would need to gather together, put in an amendment, put the amendment to a vote, and that vote would then have to carry. And even then, it's not actually a vote that turns it down. It's like a strong recommendation that we think the government should rethink this. So even if all of that you know, high coalition of numbers comes together, the government can ignore it anyway, largely. That's like the top line version of it. Like there's a little bit more Westminster politics that goes into all of it. So I think it's very unlikely that within the 40-day window that there's going to be any space for that coalition to gather. I think the next stage in terms of the arena of where this now moves to in terms of challenging it is twofold. It's the legal fight continues. You're going to have groups like Good Law Project, but others too, challenging it, trying to, you know, in some ways water it down or like challenge whether it makes sense. Because if it doesn't make sense, then it will need to be rewritten. That's the kind of action that you're going to see in the courts. I think the other thing, though, that is really interesting, and, you know, this is what QueerF was writing about this weekend in our newsletter, was the other arena this moves into, I think, is a local arena. You know, there is an option. There is a choice to be trans inclusive. And so it's up to organizations, it's up to businesses, and it's up to people like us to be making sure that being trans inclusive is the norm, that single-sex spaces don't remain single-sex spaces. Part of the code allows you to say, well, if it's not a single-sex space anymore, if you're allowing trans people in it. So,
is there not a problem with that to do with the Equality Act at the moment, where I was reading about this earlier, where some people are going to be unable to define themselves under the Equality Act as a single-sex space if they become trans inclusive?
That's right. But if it's not a single-sex space, then it's not a single-sex space. And so, you know, there's ways that I think, you know, as we unpack this, my thing, and I've been saying this actually since the Supreme Court, if we all take the decision that trans-inclusive is what we're going to be, then we've just got to work out how to do that within this code. This code leaves room for that option. So what is now really important is that we all talk about how to deliver that option at the largest possible scale. And that means doing that conversation at a local level all over the country. And then making, you know, what I think this code of practice tries to do, and it does this through the back door and it does it in a very sly way, but it tries to make being transphobic the norm, because it's just easier, frankly, to implement the transphobic version of this. So I think we as a community have a lot of agency to ensure that we show that actually being trans inclusive isn't just a good option, but, you know, the right option by history. And also the kind of option that shows you're a business that cares about all people. And, you know, I don't think I need to explain why that works economically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I'm thinking now is, you were saying that there doesn't currently exist the coalition politically to kind of make the changes that need to be made. But if we get proportional representation from Andy Burnham, I don't know, just throwing that out there, do you think that's the route to kind of like a more safe and less politically explosive option for the likes of the Labour Party, who are convinced that their base hates trans people? Maybe that offers that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if we're talking about the arenas, you know, rather than whether or not we'll get proportional representation, I would say fingers crossed. I think that would be good news for, you know, democracies all over the world. But politics could solve this, you know, like politics is all about defining the law. The courts are about making sure the law works. So the courts have said the way we understand the law works is this. Politicians could have the opportunity to rewrite that law and make it trans inclusive and change the Equality Act. So yeah, absolutely. There is a political way to solve this. What I think we don't have at the moment is any sense that this issue is a priority, as in trans people are a priority to help and support. It's not politically popular to be, you know, on the side of trans people at the moment. That's another thing that I think our community would work to change.
So this all boils down to, when did the CAST review come out? Was it 2023?
Yeah, so we're 2 years.
It's about 2023. So when it came out, it was, we were under a Conservative government at the time, were we not? Yeah, we were in that kind of changeover period. And it was presented as the evidence-based review that would settle everything at the heart of trans issues with somebody who was respected. I mean, anybody with a marginally critical eye looks at the profile of the person who was doing it and how it was carried out and how, I believe, the no trans people were consulted in the CAST review. Like, how can that happen? It sits at the foundation of so much of, like, policy, and the BMA wouldn't implement its recommendations. How compromised is the CAST review? And does the government understand that it's compromised or even care?
Yeah. So I think, you know, evidence-based review, yes, but it also dismissed 98% of the evidence that was supportive of gender-affirming care because it deemed it too low quality. So, you know, if I'm trying to be devil's advocate here, if you base the conclusion they made on the evidence they had, it makes sense that they reached that conclusion.
Okay. But
they left out a lot of the evidence. And so that's the reason why it's internationally been discredited. And I really do mean internationally. I think, you know, one of the things we do with our newsletter is trawl the receipts and the news all over the world. And it does feel like, you know, what we're 2 years on since it came out in 2024. It feels almost still weekly or monthly that a new international study comes out and disproves or shows how, you know, scientifically poorly done it was done as a piece of research. But to your other question, yes, it is an absolute backstop for everything that is coming out of the government. You know, we don't have Wes Streeting as health secretary anymore, it was, you know, held up by Streeting behind every decision. You know, this is the CAS review says it's the gold standard. And so it's become, you know, one of the things we've seen from, you know, and we see this from all governments, but it's been particularly acute in the last Conservative government and this Labour government, is them looking for or creating data and reports that provide them a shield.
Build a whole legal architecture around it.
Aren't often very sturdy themselves, but, you know, but they find this one review that backs up their point, even if, you know, 99% of the other reviews don't. If they can find one study to stand behind, they will stand behind it. And that is about, you know, being that allows them to claim they're data driven when actually what they are is ideologically driven. And that is becoming an increasingly used tool.
There's been criticism of the media, in particular the national press. The last time you and me seen each other was in one of those buildings when I was doing work for a company that had its LGBTQ thing going on, but at the same time had all its other stuff going on. And then this bizarre bun fight, it was all stuck in the same place. And I'm sure you can imagine the things that I've seen and heard. And I can tell you, I didn't know people thought like that until I was in them spaces. You know, what do you think about the way trans people are being covered in the national press over the last decade in the UK?
I mean, it's a travesty, isn't it? One of the things we quite recently put out was an article as part of our milestone series, which looked at some of the most important, you know, trans rights, but also policy shifts and changes and how they've been shaped, frankly, by the media. So we sort of traced it back 70 years of bad media coverage at every angle. I think one of the things we sometimes talk about, and I've talked about many times before, is the way the media treats trans people now is very similar to the way it treated gay people in the 80s because of the AIDS epidemic. There was that great viral quiz that made you guess between a gay headline and a trans headline, and they were kind of, you know, very difficult to tell apart. I think one of the things that's been interesting doing that particular series is tracing it back further. Actually, this transphobia in the press, it's not like a repeat of what happened in the AIDS crisis for gay men. It's just always been there. It's always been a part of the modern press to vilify and marginalize others. It's one of those tactics that drives a lot of sales and clicks for now, but back in the day, newspaper sales, you know, it's really valuable to wind everyone up, because if we're all arguing about stuff, then we've got to be reading the news more in order to understand what we're arguing about next, on a very kind of top line level. But equally, you know, to create reasons to buy these papers, it's a huge part of the tactic of the media. And I think it's a great shame, because, you know, I went to university to study journalism. And one of the things that you're taught when you do a media course like that is the principles of journalism. And I can assure you, none of that is part of the principles of journalism. That is the next stage that you get to, which is the business of journalism. I think those are two very separate things.
Yeah, it's I'm astonished by what I see in the national press. I think I kind of, I just used to shut myself down and not listen to it when I was there. But now if I'm into like Tesco and I pick up Daily Mail, yesterday, a couple of days ago, it was attacks on Andy Burnham because he's U-turned on trans issues, and it's just like a straight in. And I think they feel like it's like we're all done now. Everything's fixed. We've won the argument, and it's sad. Cray F has done some really serious journalism on the ILGA Europe reclassification, and that is the one that puts the UK alongside Russia. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, so ILGA Europe's been doing the rainbow map for quite a long time now, since 2009. It basically has quite an extensive ranking system, so you kind of get points, or countries get points for different laws that they introduce, and they've kind of created a sort of utopian country that has all of the protections that they believe LGBT people should have, and then it ranks people, countries against that. I guess what's important to take away from a UK perspective was that in 2015, so after just 6 years of this ranking, we were in the top spot. We was the best place in Europe to be an LGBTQIA plus person. Our rights beat the rest of Europe. We're, 11 years on from that? We're now 22nd, and we have dropped right down, actually into the middle of the table. But we have slid downwards every year, successively, sort of since 2015. And part of that is because other countries got better than us initially. But in more recent years, what has been notable is that our rights have degraded. And so we've been sliding down the table, not because other people are just sort of getting above us. And I think that is it's a really striking tower. You know, if you look at it's a color-based system, right? So you've got a lot of green all across Europe, and then we've got Russia in red, and it's sort of, generally speaking, it goes from sort of red to green, from Russia towards sort of Ireland. And then you've got the UK sort of slap bang in the middle, that's now gone a kind of nasty yellow, dangerously orange. No. And that's because one of the things that, you know, it's been saying year on year is the reason our score is going down is because of the way that politicians are talking about trans people. And then it was because of what politicians have done for trans people in terms of rolling back their rights. This year, the noticeable shift was that two court cases, which was, you know, the Supreme Court, which we've already talked about, but also there was a court case that reduced parental rights for trans people, so that we lost more points on that this year, which is why our ranking slid down further.
Talk to you about Wes Streeting. He's a gay man. He came up through a Labour Party that owes a substantial debt, I think, to LGBTQ plus activism. How do you explain what has happened to him on trans rights? And do you think he appreciates the damage he's been doing? I was reading your newsletter just 2 weeks ago about the language coming out of Wes Streeting towards the end of his tenure as health secretary.
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, we did an exclusive with Caroline Lipman, the bereaved mother of Alice Lipman, who died after they took their life. Been a fantastic campaigner since. After many years of asking, Wes Streeting agreed to sit down with Caroline. We got a copy of the letter that she sent to him afterwards, and we also interviewed her about how that meeting went. I can't tell you how revealing I thought that meeting was in terms of knowing Wes Streeting in a way that we maybe didn't before. I think we've known, you know, in the community for a long time that he's maybe not the best ally. I think, you know, we dug out a clip quite recently, I think in 2022, when he was talking about how he was, you know, guided by his Christian faith. In that meeting with Caroline Lipman, he was at pains, and I express pains because no one actually asked about it or brought up his faith, to set out that he wasn't a God botherer who has issues with trans people. That's like a direct quote. That's not us even like hyperbolizing, putting it in a headline. That, you know, that was something that he said. He said, "I'm not a right wing evangelical God botherer who has issues with trans people." And Caroline just spoke about how odd it was because it was so unrelated to any of the questions that she was asking, which was about, you know, her daughter, about puberty blockers, about healthcare for young people, about mental health support. But he kept bringing it up. He brought it up several times. And another thing that he brought up that I think was revealing in terms of us finding out a little bit more about the way he approaches trans people is he spoke quite adoringly and almost glamorously of a trans person he knew who passed. You wouldn't be able to tell she was a trans person, he sort of repeated. And Caroline's take on that was that he was quite, you know, part of what the way he views trans people was that, you know, an acceptable trans person is one who looks cisgender, who you couldn't possibly tell. She also said he was very preoccupied with detransition, and it seemed to be that everything he was doing was about making sure that those edge cases, those tiny fractions of people who change their mind, and I express tiny fractions, like less than a percentage, who change their minds, often because they're too scared to live in a world where transphobia would be there every day, rather than because they don't want to be trans, are the priority, as opposed to, you know, the other 99% of people who know who they are, know what they want, and want support so that they can live happy and safe lives.
There's an astonishing stuff about Street in there. Like, absolutely astounding stuff. To have the brass neck to sit there with the mother of somebody who died by suicide and to have that kind of attitude. I think that tells us everything we need to know about West Street Inn. There's an argument, I've heard it made in good faith, that Labour is governing a country where public opinion is shifted and it's their responsibility to read it. It's not what I think. I am playing devil's advocate here. How do you respond to the idea that the government has to go where the people are? It's got to be a popular government, hasn't it?
I think this government has played a role in shifting that public opinion mood. So I think it's sort of an unnuanced and a bit of a naff sort of TV punditry conversation that I kind of don't even really want to entertain. Like, if you look back a few years ago, the general public overwhelmingly supported trans rights. It's one of the things we would talk about quite a lot. You know, 2020, 2021, 2022, if you look at some of the headlines in our archive, we're talking about how the British people overwhelmingly, like huge majorities, support trans people and believe they should have rights. That has been chipped away, not just by the media, not just by the, you know, the anti-rights movements, but by politicians who have entertained that language. So the idea that they have to move with the people is absurd, because they are part of the reason that the people have moved.
And one final thing for you, Jamie. Final question. Historians are going to look back on this period for lots of reasons. A-level history students will be bored to tears with the details of this decade, I think. But what do you think they will say about Britain, about this current government, and about the people who stayed quiet actually when it really mattered?
Yeah, I think one of the things that happens in history, and it's often difficult for us to see it when we're going through it, is that pendulums swing, right? And you often see swings from left to right. We only need to look back, you know, within the last hundred years to see that happening several times across, you know, Europe. I think what's difficult at the moment is that it's quite possible that for the first time in very recent history, that instead of it sort of swinging back and then bouncing back, and thus then moving forward with that forward swing, I think it feels this time around like we've not just swung back, but we've moved that whole pendulum back, like the whole thing has been lifted up by it. So I think that's what feels particularly striking about this moment in history. But I talk about that pendulum because it is also important that it does swing, and it always swings back. And as humans, as even for us British people that have never gone through a proper revolution, we do get fed up of things. We do get fed up of the government changing our lives in ways that means that we're more restricted, and that we can't live our lives as happily or as safely or as enjoyably as we did before. And I'm very confident that there will be a tipping moment, because there always is, that will mean that the, you know, majority of people that realize that actually this distraction with trans people and migrants and gay boys, they were only ever the distraction, and now things are bad for all of us. And I'm content that that will happen.
Do you think it will come?
Yeah, but I don't think it's coming around the door corner next week or even next month.
It doesn't feel like that. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting to see the rise of the Green Party. It's interesting to see the rise of the Liberals. I think it's also worth putting that in the context that, you know, Farage's party is doing extraordinarily well, considering, you know, the fact that it has very little expertise and is frankly, speaking as someone that lives in Kent, which is sort of seen as their, you know, first attempt at sort of go, you know, there's potholes everywhere and the roads are closing left, right and center. And the locals who, you know, overwhelmingly voted them in are annoyed and frustrated. Yeah. They're out to govern. And so
this is good, is it not? You know, they've got all these councils to fuck now.
Yeah. It's what the question, I think, is whether people realize quickly enough. And that's, I think, something that is always difficult to see. You know, actually looking back at the Greens, they were in Brighton for a really long time as the council leaders. It took them successive times of getting the bins wrong for people to finally vote them out. You know, we're a fickle kind. And so
if you switch them bin collections down to monthly, people, that is the point we revolt, I think, in the UK. It seems to have been what's made a lot of reform councils up north very unpopular.
Yeah.
Jamie, it's been really good to catch up. Always a really great perspective from you. And if anybody wants to follow the amazing work that you do at Queer AF, like I'm huge fans of what you do, major respect to you guys. Can you tell them where they can find?
Absolutely, yeah. Best thing to do to... So I read the news so you don't have to. That's the idea of Queer AF. So yeah, every week our newsletter hits your inbox. Yeah, no, yeah. And so it's a really easy scan. And yeah, about 5-minute read over your coffee. I always like hearing about how people read it actually on their Saturday morning. So yeah, head to wearequeeraf.com, hit the newsletter button. And I think also worth saying, you're listening to our podcast, we've got a new season of our podcast coming out on June 1st. It's got a real mix of kind of history stories as well as some live events. It's kind of like everything you need to fight back this Pride season. So give that a listen to.
Okay, Jamie, nice one. Nice to catch up. Hopefully see you soon.
Queer politics, sex and culture. Outcast World.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.